The Hourglass by Polyphony, read by Crazy Fangirl. Baker Street is busy, irritable with the roaring of lorries, cursing cyclists, ill-tempered motorists remonstrating with each other. The drizzle is gray, oily, and cold. In other words, 9 o'clock on a normal Monday morning. The pavement outside 221 is blocked. Someone has dumped what looks like a large heap of cardboard boxes, old cases, piles of paper hastily thrust in plastic bags, and, of all things, a harpoon gun. Pedestrians glance at the mess, uninterested, and meekly walk around the obstacle. No one disturbs it. The net curtains twitch at the window of the ground floor flat, and an anxious-looking woman's face peers out, shaking her head at the scene. She lets the curtain fall and goes through into the hallway. "Sherlock," she calls, "those delivery men. They have left your stuff out on the street. You can't leave it there all day. And besides, it started to rain." "Sherlock, are you awake?" She shakes her head at the silence, then sighs and goes to put on her raincoat. On the first floor, in the room at the back of the house, where the traffic noise is dampened and the light dim, a man lies supine on an unmade double bed. Around him are packing cases, boxes, and strewn clothes as though he has recently moved from another place, started to unpack, and abruptly lost interest in the proceedings. Sherlock dreams. He doesn't strictly need pharmaceutical assistance for this, but sometimes it helps. This time it's nicotine patches, two of them. Soon he'll forget them and turn to something more brain-altering. It's an inevitable progression, and Sherlock regrets it, but he also knows he has no choice. Sherlock dreams about John. John Watson, M.D., late of the 5th Northumberland Fusiliers, currently sitting on his neatly made bed, in his neat, Spartan little bedset, wondering whether to update his blog or make comprehensive use of the pistol currently nestling in his desk drawer, illegally obtained against this very possibility. Sherlock knows he won't, or hasn't, depending on which way you look at it. Sherlock dreams fitfully, wandering through his mind. He opens doors and enters rooms, opens cupboards and drawers, removes items and studies them, allowing the flood of memories to drench him and strengthen his bonds with the events that caused them. A brown paneled door opens into his sitting room. Daylight brings light through the sash windows, an eclectic mixture of furniture, Zoffre wallpaper, and an open empty crate. Sherlock stands and breathes it all in. Yes, this could be very nice. Very nice indeed. Yes. Yes, I thought so. My thoughts precisely. So I went straight ahead and moved in. Soon as we get this rubbish cleared up, so... this is all... well, obviously I can straighten things up. A bit. Sherlock smiles, picks up the skull. What do you think, Dr. Watson? There's another bedroom upstairs, if you'll be needing two bedrooms. Well, of course we'll be needing two. Don't worry, there's all sorts round here. Miss Turner next door's got married ones. Sherlock shakes his head and closes the door softly. Another door, this time glass, revolving and etched with the business logo. How are you, buddy? How long's it been? 8 years since I last clapped eyes on you? This is my friend, John Watson. Friend, colleague. Sherlock picks up Sebastian's mobile from the desk and scrolls through the contents. He's unsurprised to find the details of Eddie Van Koon's secretary, Amanda, though he does not recall making the deduction at the time. Sherlock is quite sanguine about leaving this room. He does not anticipate visiting again. The next door opens into darkness and a narrow alley between two filthy tenements. Sherlock looks up at the narrow strip of night sky twinkling with thousands of stars. Beautiful, isn't it? I thought you didn't care about things. Doesn't mean I can't appreciate it. Sherlock shakes his head and chuckles. Strange that this tiny exchange under Vauxhall arches should have been preserved, packed and squirreled away for safekeeping. He pauses at an ill-fitting cubicle door with a sliding bolt and averts his eyes. The smell of chlorine is difficult to ignore, but he grits his teeth and walks away. He knows only too well what lies in wait for him there. Sherlock pauses at an imposing street door, Georgian and freshly painted with black gloss. His lips twitch slightly as he leans forward to open it. Do you know the big problem with the disguise, Mr. Holmes? However hard you try, it's always a self-portrait.
You think I'm a vicar with a bleeding face?
No. I think you're damaged, delusional, and believe in a higher power. In your case, it's yourself. Oh. And somebody loves you. Why, if I had to punch that face, I'd avoid your nose and teeth, too. Could you put something on, please? Anything? A napkin. Why? Are you feeling exposed?
I don't think John knows where to look.
No. I think he knows exactly where. I'm not sure about you.
If I wanted to look at naked women, I'd borrow John's laptop.
You do borrow my laptop.
I confiscate it.
Sherlock's lips twitch into a smile. He remembers his own naivete, his awkwardness when faced with John's greater experience. He looks around him. The woman had good taste in decor, he has to admit. He was sorry when she finally died. But that was in another country, and besides, he grimaces briefly at the bad taste of his own subconscious. Sherlock wonders how long he'll allow himself to wander today. He's not exactly achieving anything concrete, but after all, today is an important day. One of the most important in his life. The next door is oak, designed to look old and worn. It fastens with an iron Yale lat and a Yale lock. Sherlock raises his eyebrows as he remembers that although the cross keys couldn't give them a double room, the two adjacent with the bathroom in between was perfectly satisfactory. God, sorry, Sherlock. I didn't realize you were... Okay. I'll just wait a bit.
Problem, John? I had no idea about your streak of prudery. Unusual in a man who's spent the past decade or so in the armed forces.
Piss off, Sherlock. Just make sure you lock my side next time. When Sherlock really thought about it, it was probably the first time John had wondered. He is tempted just to walk past the next door. Just an ordinary day-to-day door, such as one would find in a hospital laboratory. But behind it...
Thinking. I need to think.
You need to... Doesn't she mean anything to you? You once have killed a man because he laid a finger on her.
She's my landlady.
She's dying, you machine!
Saw this.
You stay here if you want. On your own.
Alone is what I have. Alone protects me.
No! Friends protect people. Sherlock closes his eyes. Squeezes them shut.
even though he knows he can hardly scarcely lock out the product of his own mind. However, he tries and tries, because the door further along is from a church, and he knows exactly what lies behind it. The sky is gray, and the grass is brown and patchy. The evergreen shrubs and spiky trees frame the quiet corner with its marble-black slab, its edges new and sharp. You told me once that you weren't a hero. There are times I didn't think you were human. But let me tell you this. You were the best man and the most human being I have ever known. And no one will ever convince me that you told me a lie. And so, there. Sherlock gives a mental sigh. Those were very bad times. And John had suffered so much. He needed solace and comfort for so long that... Well, Sherlock doesn't want to think too deeply about that. But approaching the next door, he's certain that he's going to have to. To have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, till death do us part. Sherlock tries to look away, so he doesn't have to see Molly's sweet face and trembling lips as John bends to kiss her. But the whole scene is played out for him for the 100th time in HD. Sherlock wishes and wishes that he had never sneaked into the church that day, curious, but also driven by an odd Masonic urge to witness John pledge himself to another. The wave of self-discovery that followed had been deeply unwelcome, and try as he might, Sherlock knows he can never escape any of this ever again. Back in the corner of his own mind, Sherlock leans his shoulder blades against the door and tries to hold it closed. He knows the hope is a forlorn one. The door, wooden, gloss paint peeling at the edges, bears bruises and splinters from his previous efforts. All vain, to look away, to lock away, to prevent it from ever opening again, to delete it, if you like. Eventually, he gives it up as a bad job and turns to continue. Sliding doors, opening wide without his volition, a lift, empty except for the thin figure leaning on a cane, chin raised stubbornly. So let me get this straight before I punch you. John, I had little choice in the matter. You faked your own death. You disappeared for over a year. A year, Sherlock. You spent that time identifying and tracking down hitmen hired by Moriarty to take out Lestrade, Mrs. Hudson, and me. You took them out yourself. My God, how did you... Never mind. I don't want to know. And you came home, only to discover that you killed the wrong man. He was still a murderer, John. He wasn't a very nice man. And the right man then came after me, and by a total freak chance, he missed. But instead, he killed... killed... John. I'm sorry. Don't talk to me, Sherlock. Don't ever talk to me again.
Sherlock hangs his head, turns, and leaves. He sits in the corridor, unsure if he can continue, but unwilling to abandon his journey. This is, as he has said, a red leather day, and he needs to prepare for it properly. The next door he reaches is tiny, hardly large enough to accommodate a child. Sherlock stoops down and enters, shuffling across the threshold on his knees. The room is warm. He's in a cafe, sitting at a Famica top table, with white tiles, a wall. He reaches out to pick up the ketchup bottle and toys with it briefly. Look, I've asked you nicely. I've threatened you. I've even set the police on you. What does it take, Sherlock?
Don't forget about the injunction.
I'd rather, if you don't mind. Mycroft's doing, I take it?
Please. My brother does have his limitations.
Really? I suppose I'm grateful I have yet to see them. Seriously, Sherlock. Just leave me alone, now.
It's been 12 months, John.
And you think I should just get over it? Do you? You think I should be able to push everything aside and welcome you back into my life again? Your arrogance beggars belief. I don't want to talk to you.
John.
Please. Just listen for a moment. Go away, Sherlock. Just go away.
The cafe door closes in Sherlock's face. The bell jingles. Even though he knows he is in his own mind, these things are not really happening. He feels phantom tears prickling at the backs of his eyes. The next door is from the holding cells at the yard, although it opens once again into the sitting room at Baker Street. Sunlight is pouring in through the windows, but the atmosphere is hostile.
Why are you here?
You called me.
I've been calling you every day for 18 months.
Yeah, I know.
I hope your phone contract has unlimited texts. Doesn't everyone's? So why today, John?
I don't know. Maybe I just don't like storing up bad karma.
So you've come to bury the hatchet?
In a way. Lestrade told me what you did to Anderson. He won't let you come back until you have a partner.
A minder, you mean?
If you like. Anyway, I'm here. God knows why. But I'm here.
I know only too well why you're here, John. You're bored.
That's not true.
Of course you are. You're fed up signing prescriptions, doling out antibiotics, and taking blood pressures. You've seen the future yawning bare and beige in front of you, and you figure not even Sherlock Bloody Holmes would do better than that. It's not that you can't see the point anymore, can you? And you think that if you come back to Baker Street, I'll give you a point. I'll take you straight back into the bright, colorful, dangerous world where madmen strap explosives to you and gunmen shoot at you and they don't always miss. No, John.
What the... Sherlock, you've been on my case for...
The law in this country may be ass as regards to assisted suicide, John. But I draw the line at being implicated without my consent. There's nothing more to say.
the echoing clang of the door, and the scrape of the key forces Sherlock back into the corridor again. He takes a deep breath and continues on. The next door draws him in before he has a chance to resist. It's a solid wooden affair, with tubs containing bay trees on either side, and a lit sign over the lintel. The letters just blurred enough for Sherlock to be unable to identify the name. The noise inside is fierce, shockingly ornamental. The strobe lights rob his retinas of any sensitivity. The sea of gyrating bodies threatens his sense of self and stripping away any pretense of civilized behavior. He blinks under the triple assault and begins to focus. "Good evening, John. It's been a long time." "Sherlock? Oh, God! What are you wearing? On a case, are you? I can't think of any other reason you'd be in a place like this, looking like that." "The music here is a little too loud for conversation." "What makes you think I want to have a conversation with you?" "You are not sure what you want to do. However, curiosity wars with anger and is currently winning. What's your poison?" "You're offering me to buy me a drink. In a place like this, that's tantamount for a proposition. I'm quite sure you'll cope." A faint smile flits across Sherlock's lips. He remembers this case, the time, the drink he bought for John, and the conversation they had that evening. Sherlock did indeed catch his prey later on that week. A serial date rapist armed with copious quantities of home-synthesized roofies who preyed on vulnerable young men in gay bars. By luring him into a back alley behind the club where, of course, John was waiting with his gun. Sherlock moves around the room and through a small metal door with a sliding window into the interior of a taxi. "You're a maniac. You know that." "Very little changes, John. We just get more so as we grow older." "I must be out of my mind running around with you again. Keeps you off the Prozac." "Oh, I ought to land one on you for that." "Probably. But you won't. Instead, you're going to come home with me." "Now, why on earth would I want to do a crazy thing like that?" "Because you're not quite sure whether he got me with that tiny little braid or not. And you know I'm not going to tell you. So the only solution is for you to tail me." "Give it up, John. We can split the taxi fee." "I don't know why I bother."
"Yes, you do."
Something twists in Sherlock's chest. It feels good revisiting these memories in the correct order. But it's bittersweet, like dark chocolate. And too much is making him feel brimful and pained. The memories are coming thicker and faster now. The doors are closer together. He knows he does not have time to visit all of them. But he finds himself scanning them closely, looking for the signs of the one he cannot walk past. Finally, he sees it, nestling in the recess set back from the wall. He identifies it by the ironwork door knocker in the shape of a double scroll and notes that the door is in fact ajar, unlike any of the others. Beyond it is the sitting room of 221B, once again. Strewn with Sherlock's usual debris, but lacking any evidence of John's presence.
Move back in.
No.
You haven't even thought about it, John.
I don't have to. No.
That's ridiculous. Your flat is a long tube journey away. It's further away from the surgery than Baker Street. You have to change 3 times to get okay.
Okay. I get it. But the answer is still no, Sherlock.
Is this about what happened?
No! Oh, God, no. No, that's in the past. I wish it were different, but... Well, it wasn't all down to you, Sherlock. After all, you suffered too.
Yes. So why won't you move back in?
I can't, Sherlock. It would be... inappropriate.
Are we talking about your lifestyle? Because if you are, there's really no problem, John. Mrs. Hudson has no objections. In fact, would probably welcome...
Yes, yes, thank you. I realize that her wildest fantasies would probably be made true.
Well, not the wildest ones, perhaps.
What do you mean?
Oh, John, don't be naive. The ones where she imagines herself talking to Mrs. Turner about her own
married ones?
Yes.
Well, that's pretty much the problem.
Mrs. Turner's married ones?
No, Sherlock. Mrs. Hudson's. Sherlock smiles and leans against the wall, letting the scene play out in his mind.
Can I take it that you were proposing marriage to me?
Proposing? Oh, for God's sake, Sherlock, keep your voice down.
Mrs. Hudson's out, if that's what you're worried about. No,
that's not what I'm worried about. I'm worried about you jumping to totally unnecessary conclusions.
I see nothing unnecessary in matrimony between two like-minded people.
Yes. Well... That's assuming that you and I are like-minded. Knowing your mind as I do, that's a very big assumption.
Stop putting up gratuitous barriers. If matrimony means that you will move back to Baker Street, I'm prepared to give it serious consideration.
What? I don't believe I'm hearing this. Sherlock, we're not even dating. You're not even interested in sex or relationships. You told me that yourself.
No, I didn't, John. I said I wasn't looking, which, at the time, was perfectly true.
All right. All right. So what are you telling me? Sherlock's eyelids flutter. And the set of his body becomes languid as he remembers how he kissed John's surprised mouth. How he walked him backwards through the living room door and to his own bedroom. He remembers how he took the clothes from John's body with his fingers and the words from his lips with his own. And then... having John spread out and trembling against Sherlock's dark blue sheets, taking a deep breath, and then putting his hands, then his mouth, on John's skin. Sherlock's eyes drift close as he remembers John's hesitancy, his doubts, and his fears. And his eventual passionate surrender when Sherlock makes clear that inexperience does not necessarily mean ineptitude, especially when your partner has intimate knowledge of your body spiraling back over 30 years. Sherlock finds he is breathing rather more heavily than usual, despite the fact that he is still in his own mind and does not need air here. A certain sense of urgency comes into his mind when he realizes that he's lingered too long in this room. Time waits for no man, not even him. And he has an appointment with destiny. Sherlock walks down his endless corridor until he stops in front of another door. This one, rough-hewn oak with a black iron latch.
But what are we doing here? Sherlock, where's the crime?
Seems to be just another one of the old cottage to me. Admittedly a very pretty one, but
there's no crime here, John. Well, apart from the fact that this place is not being lived in right now. That's probably crime of the hot water.
What do you mean? Who owns this house?
I do.
What? How?
I inherited it.
Oh, don't tell me. Grateful client?
Not at all. A grateful uncle. Grateful I stopped visiting him when I was 17. Both his wives divorced him after I exposed his infidelities. I was 17 and 10, respectively.
And he still gave you his cottage?
Certainly. He spent a very contented retirement shacked up with his valet, happy as Larry, until the day he died. Did you notice that there are beehives at the bottom of the garden?
Bees are fascinating creatures.
I might consider conducting some research on their behavior. After I finished my paper on the polyphonic monettes of the Renaissance composer Orlando de la Rose.
Sherlock, wait a minute. Are you suggesting we live here?
Well, yes, John. Of course I am. After all, it's a perfect retirement place. And you know, with your increasing deafness, you're finding the traffic noise at Baker Street more and more intolerable as the years go by.
Well, yes, that's true, but...
And whilst crime and criminals are truly fascinating, I must confess it's a very long time since I've come across a truly original crime. Boring and pedestrian, most of them.
So let me get this straight.
You want us to relocate from Baker Street to this little cottage.
Sherlock, what are we going to live on?
My trust fund, John. Same as always. What? Didn't you know? Where did you think the rent came from when we weren't earning? Or when you moved out?
I suppose I didn't really think about it.
That much is true. No, this is perfect for us. Quiet, rural, with decent access and facilities.
You're intending to go back to London occasionally, then?
Of course. We'll let out the other two flats of Baker Street, but we'll keep ours as a little parterre for when we want to go and annoy Lestrade.
He's up for retirement, too, you know.
Yes, I know. I invited him to the ceremony. Donovan, too.
Ceremony?
Yes, do keep up, John. The civil partnership ceremony on Tuesday at the registry office.
I have a new suit made for you. You just need to come and choose a shirt.
Sherlock smiles, remembering John's bewildered expression.
He glances down the corridor at a slightly slower pace, skimming past doors until he finds the one he's looking for. A plain wooden affair with an ivy wreath hung over the knocker.
We have entrusted our brother Gregory to God's mercy, and now we commit his body to the ground. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope.
It could have been worse.
Yes, at least the address was short.
I meant his last illness, Sherlock.
No death is good, John. Just inevitable.
That's very philosophical.
Today is the day for philosophy. Shall we?
For a little while. I could do with a cup of tea. Don't forget, our train's in 2 hours. Unless you want to spend another night at Baker Street?
No.
Too many memories?
I'm 68, John. The mattress is hell on my joints.
I'm even older and it doesn't bother me.
Then be grateful for your good fortune. Without your hearing implement, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Well, not without a tablet and stylus. Certainly. Greg had a good life.
Cliched nonsense. That's what people say when they want to comfort themselves against their own mortality.
My, we are in a snit today, aren't we?
It's no good pretending, John.
You're just worried I'll go first, aren't you? Sherlock?
I don't think this is something I want to discuss now.
When and where else are we going to discuss it? Come here.
Losing you would be like excusing my brain, John. The pain would be unendurable.
I think you're going to have to resign yourself to it someday, Sherlock. After all, I'm betting you wouldn't want to miss something as important event in my life,
The closing door echoes around the corridor with a resounding boom. Sherlock continues to walk, but his step has lost its spring. His face is serious and thoughtful. The door is smooth, agronomically designed, made of a lightweight alloy with an unfamiliar gleam. He pauses, his hand on the lock. Then he opens it and walks into the hospital room. John is on the bed, who on intents and purposes is sleeping. He is older here and evidently very ill. His skin is as white as the bed linen and somehow as transparent as though his spirit is impatient to fly free and is trying to take his body with it. As Sherlock gazes at him, his eyes open, and he coughs weakly. Not dead yet, then?
No. You'll have to try harder.
Bored with me already? That didn't take long.
Only 10 years. Most marriages don't last that long.
That's not true, Sherlock.
Prove it. Get out of that bed and come with me. We'll go down to Somerset House this afternoon. They'll have all the data we need to come up with an answer.
Nice try. But I think I'll stay here, if you don't mind.
As a matter of fact, I do. If you're too lazy to move your backside out of this bed, I'm stuck with keeping you company.
You could log into the hospital Wi-Fi.
Already on. Nothing interesting. Correction. Nothing more interesting than you.
Than watching me die.
It's a natural progress, John. No, natural processes always are infinitely fascinating to me.
Nice to know. The nearer I get to my maker, the more consideration I get from you.
You always were an attention seeker, John.
Sherlock lowers his eyes and stares at his shoes. He turns and leaves the room very quietly. Although he knows that nothing in heaven or on earth could disturb or delete these memories now. He stands for a long time, just looking down the corridor of his own mind. To his left,
runs the myriad collection of doors that represent his memories. Large and small, decorative and plain, rough and smooth. He sighs and turns to his right, where the corridor runs on, blank and featureless. No more doors. No more memories. He turns back to the hospital door and runs a curious hand over it. These are his oldest memories, the ones he began his life with. It isn't a huge leap to deduce why that might be. Sherlock. The voice is quiet but insistent. Sherlock sighs and retraces his steps along the corridor. He passes each door in turn, nodding occasionally to one he didn't visit this time around, but may return to in the future, and lingers, trailing thin fingers over a double scroll of a certain door knocker. Sherlock. Sherlock knows he must leave this place now. In fact, the presence of that voice means that he is overdue. He walks briskly down the corridor, past the brown panel door he first entered, and turns a sharp left into daylight. Sherlock. Sherlock opens his eyes to see a familiar features of his brother. He scowls and turns on his side, facing away from the bland, expressionless face. It's time, Sherlock. The beautiful, modulated tones of his fall on his ears like snow in winter, beautiful and inexorable as ice. Sherlock sighs. He turns over and rolls off his bed, skimming past his immaculately dressed visitor into his bathroom. When he emerges sometimes later, he is dressed in a sharp black suit with a white shirt, and his hair is curled, shining with some kind of product. Mycroft gives him a once-over with a faint smile. You're not intending to seduce him at the first meeting, Sherlock, he says chidly. There's no need to try quite so hard. Sherlock brushes past his brother and throws himself on the sofa. I made you tea, Mycroft says, sipping from his own cup. The silence is deafening. Finally, Mycroft sighs and sets his cup on the coffee table and comes to sit next to his brother. There truly is no other way, Sherlock, he says quietly. Sherlock flings himself violently off the sofa. I don't need your pity, he spits scornfully. He paces the room. Nevertheless, you have it anyway. Mycroft's tone doesn't change, as does anyone with your form of chronodisplacement. He rises from the sofa unhurriedly and moves over to where his brother stands by the window, motionless, staring unseeingly into the street. Research continues, he says quietly, but the progress is slow. Too slow for me, Sherlock grates. In fact, it's too late for me now. The part of my life, the only part worth living, is finished. Indeed, agrees Mycroft. And all you can do now is grit your teeth and try to live out the next 34 years as you have done in the past. The lack of control is maddening, I know, Mycroft interrupts. But there is no other way of halting or reversing it. I can't even die. No, Mycroft agrees. Although that will happen in the future, at least for me. For you, it has already happened, and you cannot change it. Mycroft lies a gentle hand on his brother's shoulder. Sherlock, I promise I will look after you and your doctor throughout my future. As I have done in your past, he says solemnly. Now, I think you need to depart for St. Bartholomew's Hospital. You don't want to be late for your appointment.
Sherlock snorts diversively, but shrugs on his greatcoat and knots his scarf. He exchanges a long look with his brother, and then turns on his heel and careens down the steps of 221B. Tomorrow, Mycroft will kidnap Dr. Watson to a disused warehouse somewhere in Camden Town to have a detailed and personal conversation with him about his relationship with his brother. Tomorrow, Sherlock will go back to his miserable little flat on Montague Street and cook up enough explosive material to take out the ceiling. He will be summarily evicted and only escape criminal charges because he knows about his landlord's sideline in stolen laptops. The day after, Mycroft will read in the tabloids the details of a successful solving of serial suicides by Scotland Yard detectives, and he will send an ironic little text to his brother. The day after, Sherlock will flush the last of his cocaine and smoke down and smoke the last of his cigarettes before embarking on his quest to finally get clean. And so it will go on and on. Mycroft will proceed smoothly into the future, knowing that Sherlock has already been there and that nothing can be changed. And Sherlock will delve back into the past, having already discovered what to expect from it. But for now, Sherlock has this day. This final day. To say hello and goodbye to Dr. John Watson. And he intends to do it well. The end.